coming back and finding that your draft board accepted the year and a half as your alternative service.
Right.
And regretting, of course, that you hadn't, as many did, to have a more circuitous route back to the United States. What did you do? How did you feel about reentering American society after a year and a half in Vietnam? And what was American society like?
I didn't, in a lot of ways, really re-enter American society at that point, I don't think. But I think the thing that struck me more forcefully than almost anything else was how wasteful everybody was. The stuff that got thrown away that would not have had time to hit the pavement in Vietnam. That kind of feeling was reinforced later, too, just in thinking about things like the kind of bridge construction that goes on in building a typical urban freeway system in this country, and how far that number of bridges would go in a place like Vietnam. In a lot of ways, I found it psychologically more difficult to adjust to coming back to the United States than I had found it to adjust to going to Vietnam in the first place. But at the same time, I also fairly quickly, I did a couple of things. I did some pretty intense reading. My family lived in Austin, Texas at the time, very close to the University of Texas. I spent a lot of time in the library there, reading especially about China and the Chinese Revolution and trying to understand what parallels there might be there for the Vietnamese experience. And then I also did some grassroots kind of anti-war agitation, I guess, is what you could call it. I put together a slideshow with tape with the help of some friends and put together a show of photographs and just found places in churches around Texas that I could go and show this stuff. I somehow or another got on the agenda of one of the Southern Presbyterian denominational conferences, not as an official presenter, but I mean, I was there along with some other people with a variety of third world concerns, presenting a perspective on Vietnam, showing that slideshow that I had put together, and just being there and talking with people. And so I was only back in this country for 6 months before I went back out to Asia again.
Mm-hmm. And when you went back to Asia, what did you do?
So when I went back, I had been recruited to be a field representative for Committee of Responsibility. Mm-hmm. Dennis Rothar was out there in that role already, and I came out and joined him. It was a 6-month stint. They fired me after 5 months. And then I went out. I had one backpack and one paper bag, and I left for a 6-month job, and I came back about 4.5 years later with 30-odd baskets and boxes and bundles of various sorts after having spent that 6 months in Vietnam and traveled a little bit around Southeast Asia and working for 6 months in Hong Kong and working for a little over 3 years in Japan.
Mm-hmm. Let's walk our way through here, not briskly, but in other words, a level of detail, since this isn't IBS directly,
right,
IBS related, but just to complete this picture. Dennis worked for the Americans for Responsibility and
Committee of Responsibility.
Committee of Responsibility, right. And so did, actually, I think Dennis replaced John Balaban. That I think John
was
went home when
and
Dennis
John was
got
working
it.
in the U.S. office, mm-hmm. and he recruited me, and he also was the person who was given the mission of purging me when I became unacceptable.
Well, why did you become unacceptable? Because I can think of a lot of reasons why, by the way.
The primary problem was that Dennis and I were there at the time when the first kids started coming back after treatment mm-hmm. in the United States. Mm-hmm. And we saw the impact on these kids and on their families when they were returned to their families in a Vietnamese village. And there was a huge cultural discontinuity there. The COR archives are now in some university.
Mm-hmm.
And I just happened to come across that when I was doing a search on the web for mm-hmm. things that might include the name Spraggins.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't remember what university it is, mm-hmm. but it's probably somewhere in Pennsylvania
mm-hmm.
because Dr. Herb Needleman was from Philadelphia and he was the, mm-hmm. the head of it. But John Balaban had recruited me. Dennis and I were out there when the first kids started coming back. They were having huge problems readjusting to mm-hmm. life in Vietnam after being pampered in the United States. We were in a situation where, in theory, COR was supposed to have a physician in the field to evaluate kids. And during the time that we were there, there was only 1 month when there was a doctor in the field. And our approach was that only kids who really needed treatment that they could not possibly get in Vietnam mm-hmm. Should go to the United States because of the cultural dislocations.
And just for a note, the Committee of Responsibility was organized to provide advanced, what was thought to be advanced medical care for Vietnamese children
who were injured in the war.
Injured in the war. This eventually developed into, many Vietnamese saw this as an affront that they couldn't provide for their own. Some volunteers working for the committee said, well, why don't we set up hospitals here that can do that work? The idea of sending them home had a kind of ownership of America, that Americans were doing something only Americans could do.
Well,
what do you think about that?
But the thing yeah. was that Committee of Responsibility mm-hmm. was not set up as a politically neutral organization.
Mm-hmm.
It was a group of people who were opposed to the war.
Right.
And in addition to providing complex forms of treatment, often cross-disciplinary,
mm-hmm.
treatment that either was not available at all in Vietnam or in cases where it was difficult to coordinate the
mm-hmm.
specialties that were needed to treat someone's
mm-hmm.
condition, would be taken to the United States, where they would be evidence of the war's atrocity
mm-hmm.
in the face of Americans.
Mm-hmm.
So, although that side of it was not stated explicitly, so far as I know,
mm-hmm.
That was a definite part of the consciousness of the people who were involved in it. The level of medical expertise available in Vietnam was changing over time, and so certain things were possible in Vietnam that had not been possible before.
Mm-hmm.
We were hampered by the lack of a committee physician on the ground, but the people back in Philadelphia saw both Dennis and me as being obstructionist. And
what were you obstructing?
The export of children to the United States.
Uh-huh.
You know, not pursuing that.
So you were
as
an ally. You were an ally
wanted.
Of Dennis's in that. The two of you were associated with the same criticism. Is
right.
What I'm trying to get
right.
At. Okay.
Right.
Okay.
So, anyway, there was that purge,
mm-hmm.
and the history of COR went on
mm-hmm.
its own, and it's documented in correspondence files that are available
mm-hmm.
in some university off somewhere.
No, I'll ask you about that. I'll remind you to ask about what website if you ever come across it again.
Well, is it's also you could do a search on Alta Vista or Excite probably find that.
Okay. I'll just give it. No, the thing is, I think it's interesting for a student to do it as a term paper.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to get everybody online, oriented to surfing
mm-hmm.
as part of their thing. And I was so delighted when I said for this for this week's seminar, you know, you need to read this. It's on reserve. It's something I wrote.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, oh, no, we've already downloaded it off the net.
Great.
I mean, before I had even assigned it,
uh-huh.
they had already read it
mm-hmm.
On the net. They, you know, they just were cruising along. Yeah. Yeah. And they saw it, and it was great. And it was downloadable 19 pages, but to Xerox it was 50.
Mm.
So it worked out really nice. But
one of the things that's sort of an interesting sidelight here, I flew to Vietnam in 1967. The month that would have been my sixth month in COR, I spent recovering from hepatitis.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was just sort of hanging out at the IBS house. Fortunately, they were open
mm-hmm.
to ex-IVSers doing things like that.
Mm-hmm.
I flew from Vietnam to Phnom Penh,
mm-hmm.
and there was this corkscrew ascent out mm-hmm. of Saigon and the long glide path into Phnom Penh Airport, and that was just really an incredible contrast and set the stage for the couple of weeks that I spent Cambodia.
Mm-hmm.
And I did not fly again until, what was it? I guess the next time I flew from the United States out to Asia, and I'm trying to remember, I don't think there was another time until 1979, but I went overland from Cambodia to Thailand, down through Malaysia to Singapore. I took a ship, the last sailing of one of the ships of the old French Messagerie Maritime,
mm-hmm.
To Hong Kong, in one of these seven bunks to a cabin kind of classes.
Mm-hmm.
I took a Russian cruise ship out of Hong Kong 6 months later after having worked as an English teacher with volunteers in Asia.
Mm-hmm.
Then from Japan, after teaching there for a little over 3 years.
With any organization? Or?
I was teaching at a private girls' high school there that a friend had lined me up.
Okay.
Yeah, she was a wife in a missionary family who had been teaching there part-time, and they wanted a full-time teacher.
So Chris was in Volunteers in Asia before he was in IBS. And you
were
volunteers
in Asia
after your IBS. Well, to make a long story short, when you finished these stints in Asia, what did you think you were going to do? I mean, how have you led up to where you are now? Did you decide to go into journalism? Was there a commitment to a career? Was there a belief you'd spend enough time in Asia?
Well, I got into writing and journalism because there was something I wanted to write about,
mm-hmm.
which was the war in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
So back in this country, I came back to the United States from Japan because I thought if I didn't come back at that point, I just wouldn't.
Mm-hmm.
I would just stay there. And I felt some vague kind of obligation to come back and I don't know, be a leavening force in American society or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sort of sorry to see IVS now for the various combinations of good reasons moving away from recruiting American volunteers, because I think that it's not just a matter of providing development support in the countries where IVS is working. I think it's a matter of providing Americans with the kind of understanding that you can only get by living for an extended period.
So you're opposed to the way IBS
culture.
Is now going.
Yeah,
yeah, that's
I regret that.
Yes. I think.
So I came back, and worked. Oh, it was 1974. That was the next time I flew.
Mm-hmm.
I came back. I worked for most of 6 months with Don Luce and others in the Vietnam Mobile Education
mm-hmm.
Project,
mm-hmm.
Set up a dark room and a bathroom in this little office building in Washington and printed up stuff that they were using for their refurbishing their traveling exhibit,
mm-hmm.
And then went out to Vietnam in '74,
mm-hmm.
writing for the paper, the American report that was published by Clergy and Laity Concern.
Mm-hmm.
And then came back to the States after that trip and worked with David Marr and the group that was doing the Southeast Asia Resource Center.
The Southeast Asia Resource Center.
And by that point, I felt like I'd been in several foreign countries, including Berkeley, long enough that I really needed to find out what America was mm-hmm. like. And I went off I'm compressing mm-hmm. some things. Mm-hmm. I'm skipping over a period where I holed up at my mother's house and translated Van Tien Zung's VanTiendung book, Our Great Spring Victory, mm-hmm. which was published by Monthly Review Press.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, then I specifically set out to get a newspaper job in small town Texas.
Mm-hmm.
And at two different newspapers in small town Texas.
Mm-hmm.
I worked for about 3 years. And then got recruited back to what was by then the Southeast Asia Resource Center mm-hmm. instead of the Indochina Resource Center.
Mm-hmm.
Worked there for a while, moved to the Indochina Project in Washington.
Was John McAuliffe running it then? Or?
No, this was a different thing mm-hmm. from what John's doing.
Okay.
This, Murray Hebert, who now writes for the Far Eastern Economic Review,
mm-hmm.
Was heading that.
Mm-hmm. I was thinking the Indochina Reconciliation Project.
Yeah,
but this
different.
Is the Indochina Project, right? That's
right.
Different. Yeah.
Right. And it no longer exists.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
in that time, Saigon, you know, fell, that's quotes, to the communists. What was your reaction when that happened?
Yay!
Yay!
I was bemused by the whole idea of the falling as if something were cracking off the edge of the shelf, but I was watching the news every night as mm-hmm. the map turned redder and redder, and being amazed at how fast it was happening. See, I had, and regretting that I was not there, because I had left right at the end of 1974, avoiding difficulties I might have faced in trying to renew my visa.
Mm-hmm.
At the end of a year there, having gotten the clear sense from my plugged-in political Vietnamese friends that nothing was likely to happen in the next year, nothing major,
hmm.
that things were likely to keep on as they had been. And it was clear then in General Zung's memoir that they hadn't expected anything to happen so fast either.
Mm-hmm.
But this probing action around Ban Metuit had led to such a precipitous collapse that they just kept pushing and pushing, and things were falling apart faster than they could follow up by the end there. So, you know, I don't think my friends were misleading me.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think anybody expected that to happen. So I had this mixture of cheering it on and kicking myself mm-hmm. for being on this side of the ocean and not on that.
Because, mm-hmm. You know, the funny thing is your name was so familiar to me when I just saw it on the list. But, you know, so Schaefer, you know, those are familiar names. They're not, you know, names you've never heard before. But, of course, I own The Great Spring Victory. I mean,
yeah.
I own your book.
Okay.
So it's like you know, that's why it seems so familiar, which is funny.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, what do you call it? Foreign, you know, the FIBIS. Yes, did that, was
Foreign
that
Broadcast
your,
Information Service.
Was that your translation that they...
No,
no.
Is their translation was done before.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, their specialty is quick and dirty translation, and sometimes from preliminary publication sources. I don't know whether their translation was based on the book or on a newspaper serialization of it. I've got it stuck away,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Well, I'm curious
the archives,
because the volume two, the FIBIS volume two, is apparently hard to get for some reason. People are always asking me, because it was published in two sections.
I had forgotten that.
I think so.
I've got the whole thing somewhere.
Well, we'll be. I just made a note of it in case someone asks me. I know we can. The from 1975 to 19. Well, so you went back in 1987.
My. No, well,
I'm just asking. How did you? Why did you go back in 1987? What was that part of? Was that with Don Lewis's group or?
I went back. Yeah. I went back in 74. Okay, then back in this country. I went to Vietnam in 1980. This was a Southeast Asia Resource Center backed trip. We were doing retrospectives 5 years after the end of the war on all the Indochina countries, and so I did a large part of the Vietnam retrospective and wrote a bunch of stuff that was published out in other places as well. I tried to go to Vietnam in 1983 when I was at the Indochina Project in Washington, was able to get a visa for Cambodia, was not able to get a visa for Vietnam, which was curious at the time because normally only Vietnam approved people, it was thought, got visas to Cambodia.
I can guess why. We'll get to that in a second. But in 1987...
And then it was 1988 that was my last trip, and I went to both Vietnam and Cambodia on that trip.
Is that doing it just yourself? Or?
That trip was... And that trip is on the web, by the way. On my resume, you'll see a URL. Follow that, and you'll see my reporting from that trip. That trip was done under joint sponsorship by the newspaper where I worked, the Daytona Beach News Journal, and Cox, which is a part owner of that paper. So it was distributed by Cox, and then Cox stuff is distributed by the New York Times Wire. Not a whole lot of it got picked up beyond our paper. And that was my last trip out.
Well, that you spent a lot of time connected with Asia, and a lot of time connected with, a bit of time with IVS and other NGOs. Any suggestions? Well, let's say you had to supply humanitarian aid to, like, Somalia. Is there anything from the experience you've learned of how to make that more effective?
I don't know, and I think there are situations where there just is not an effective way to do solid aid. I think the part of the problem is that in cases like Somalia, we don't do anything until it's a crisis, and by the time it gets to be a crisis, there's nothing that you can do that will have a good outcome. But since I was involved more less at the level of relief aid, my perspective is not one that gives me the kind of hands-on experience that somebody like a Herb Bruce or a Dennis Rothar might have. So my senses are more at a theoretical level and have to do with general concepts about working in situations that are not in crisis and in a nebulous sort of way, not really saying that I could go in and do this, but being able to identify people who are respected in communities and finding ways to just give them a little bit of extra resource, a little bit of extra training, so that they can do the things that they understand how to do.
Of course, that leaves out that dimension that we think is so important, that is Americans. Americans doing relief work, not because they deliver better relief work, but so that they can get an experience, you know, beyond the United States. Is there a place where those things can
get
together?
As I was just reading this thing in the strike paper out of Detroit about these kids who have been participating in Union Summer and coming in with a fresh outside perspective, just doing the gutsy kind of things that more settled people sometimes aren't willing to do, of walking through stores and talking to employees in the stores to try to encourage them to join the union. There is an advantage to just sort of shaking things up a little bit. There is both an advantage and a disadvantage to being an outsider and not having to suffer the consequences of trouble you may stir up locally. And if part of the root of problems you're trying to deal with is entrenched ways and entrenched powers, there are times when an outsider can come in, and if that person is sensitive, can apply a bit of leverage to bust things loose in a way that somebody who lives there could not do on their own. Now, I don't know, I've come over the years to really wonder about how much people and institutions change. Americans after the end of the war, for the most part, lost all the fervor that went into the anti-war demonstrations. And there's some essay lurking in the way that the MIA issue has been manipulated to turn butchers into victims and lift the load of guilt. And there's not a lot of long-term impact, I don't think, in American society from that movement. It was something that was born out of a national crisis, which was an amalgamation of personal crises, and I think that it takes a really emotionally deep and wrenching personal crisis to make someone change their habitual behavior. And I think that the length of time that behavior changes is relatively short, unless something keeps propelling it forward. So I assume that is largely the case in other countries as well. And when I look at Vietnam today, I think, now wait a minute, what's different about what's happening in Vietnam now and what would be happening in Vietnam if Saigon had won? And apart from the fact that the government is led by a party that calls itself the Communist Party, I'm not sure that there's that much difference.
And yet, perhaps if the United States had not involved itself in Vietnam at all, and the communists had won, what would be happening in Vietnam today would still be happening in Vietnam today.
Possible. I mean, what the communists were and how they reacted at various stages of Vietnam's history was shaped to a great degree by the fact that the war was going on, the fact that they hadn't gotten support for their early independence movement, that there had not been decolonization of Vietnam at the end of World War II. And actually things might, you know, you're a historian, you know how impossible it is
exactly
to speculate.
That's a lecture that I just give them, what you've just said. Yes, historians do speculate in that way, but it's designed to stimulate more study rather than to define an outcome.
Yeah.
And what's interesting is that the communism in Vietnam became what it became because of the war. That communism in Vietnam wouldn't have ended up in the hands of the Stalinists, perhaps, had it not been for the war. So the war had the unintended effect of pushing Vietnam closer to China and to put hardliners into power in Hanoi.
Yeah.
But the point I'm working on is that Vietnam has always responded pragmatically to changes in world historical forces.
Mm-hmm.
At least initially, it's always tried the pragmatic way and not an ideologically based solution. And obviously, Vietnam would have had to respond to the perestroika under any circumstances, which is what it's doing now. So the real issue is now we have this triumphalism saying, see, we won the war. They're more like us now. And the point is, we could have even not had the war, and they could be more like us now.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's...
It just depends where you want to take your dividing
path.
Where
you can take the left and the right, and you can put them on either side. You can say the left says, see, we wouldn't have had to fight the war. The right says, see, we won.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
both are ahistorical, because one's speculative and the other is, of course, ridiculous. Because the object of the Vietnam War was not to produce a bunch of capitalists in Vietnam, or make Vietnam capitalists. It was to create an independent Vietnam capable of defending itself that wasn't run by communists. And that happened. That is, the communists took over the country, so that means we lost. That was our definition of victory. So by our definition, we lost the war. The communists won. Now, if you want to talk about world history, 1,000 years ago,